This is episode number 4 of Store and Forward, a podcast about the past and future of amateur radio. I am Kay Savitz, K6KJN. I am the curator of the Digital Library of Amateur Radio and Communications at the Internet Archive, and I am here with my buddy,
Steve Stroh, N8GNJ, and I am the editor of the Zero Retries newsletter, which focuses on the future of amateur radio.
How come you get to be the future and I'm stuck in the past?
We each have our roles, and I lean heavily on DLARC. I don't say this often enough, but I lean heavily on DLARC as a source of inspiration. I wrote a blog post for the Internet Archive that apparently was well received, at least by the boss, and about how there have been times when amateur radio has tried to tackle various projects and other things that the technology or the audience just was not quite up to. And we now have better technology, and we have an influx of new amateur radio operators that are a whole new generation, and they are eager for challenges, and we just have to get those challenges that we tried and didn't quite pull off in front of them. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in my what's become a new thrust of Zero Retries. So
awesome. Well, you know, I rely on Zero Retries to learn. One of the ways I learn about what's happening currently, so I, because I'm always looking for new things to add to DLARC. So, like, you're one of the news sources that I use. So nice. I just the other couple days ago got back from my little field trip to Lima, Ohio, to Fair Radio Sales. You've been there, right? You've seen
I did. So my history with Fair Radio goes way, way back. I remember literally sitting in high school study hall, poring over the most recent Fair Radio Sales catalog, and they were so kitschy it was cool. That every product label in the catalog was done with Dymo tape, you know, and then the whole page was photographed. But each one of the descriptions was, you know, a Dymo embossed label, and the range of things were just amazing. And I had bought little bits and pieces over the years from Fair Radio, and then finally, after a hamvention, when we had a little bit of extra time in traveling, I decided I was going to try and visit on a Monday morning. And it was a rainy Monday morning, and I was the only customer. And so they had no problem with me just wandering what they called the stacks. And these were, well, as you saw, these are, you know, 20-foot high racks, you know, they seem to stretch into infinity. It really reminded me of the Indiana Jones warehouse scene. And what was amazing was that there was one part of the roof that was leaking onto this rack, and nobody cared because there was so much other stuff, and they weren't going to put the time and money into repairing that particular portion of the roof. So tell your tale about Fair Radio Sales.
Yeah, sure. So, I just looked up the email in September of 2023. So almost a year ago, I had read that Fair Radio was going to be closing down. The proprietor, Philip, has been running the place for 40 years or something like that, and he's ready to retire. And so I emailed him on that day, and I explained what DLARC is. I said that we are massive library of radio and communications, and I thought that he probably had a lot of radio manuals and catalogs. And would he be willing to donate them to us? And we had a productive conversation, and he basically said he might be willing to do that, but first he didn't want to sell off as much as he could. So he was going to go to, you know, Dayton Hamvention, and he was going to have an auction and this and that. I'm like, oh, fine, okay, well, we'll do what we can do. And as it got closer to his date of shutting down, Philip made the generous decision to let us get in there and take what we wanted prior to his big auction, which I think actually starts tomorrow as we record this, on August 16th. And he said we could take whatever we want. So that's what we did. And me and two assistants showed up at their warehouse and started digging through all the manuals. Now, as you know, and I'll show some pictures in a few minutes, Fair Radio has just enormous number of amount of gear, of radios and equipment, and all sorts of hardware. And that's not what I need for DLARC. I was only looking for the magazines and the manuals and the catalogs and things like that. So I flew out to Fort Wayne, Indiana, and I got there late on a Friday night. And my intention was to rent a U-Haul truck that night. And there, U-Haul has a nice little app, and I did a reservation. I said, I'm going to arrive at 10 o'clock at night, and I'm going to want my U-Haul, even though I know no one's going to be there. You know, it's fine. So I get there, and you know, my flight lands, and I take an Uber to the U-Haul place and use the app, and it's just like, your equipment is not ready. Your equipment is not requisitioned for you. So that was an inauspicious start to the whole project. So I went to find a hotel, went to bed, got up the next morning, got there at opening time. And they were just like, no, we don't have it for you. We don't have the van. I'm like, I reserved this van months ago. And they were just like, no. So found another U-Haul place across town. It was only 3 miles away. Took another Uber to get over there. They were much nicer and had the equipment for me. And then so I finally had a U-Haul, 9-foot van, and I drove that bad boy to Lima, Ohio, to Fair Radio Sales. Took about an hour and 20 minutes. And met Philip, and my helpers were already there, and they were building cardboard boxes. And we started to box up everything. And we were there for 10 hours on the first day and about 9 hours on the second day. Remember last time we talked about the Bob Cooper collection, and I was in that warehouse in Denver, and I was excited because I had acquired 18 boxes of videotapes and 21 boxes of magazines and books and things.
Mm-hmm.
This time, I came away with 200 boxes of material. It took two van loads. We boxed up things. I filled up the van to its carrying capacity and drove the material back to Fort Wayne, where Internet Archive has a scanning center in the Allen County Public Library basement, and unloaded everything, turned around, went back to Lima, and we did it again. So it was two full van loads. 200 boxes of material that will take quite a long time to scan for, you know, for them to get through it all. I expect it could take more than a year. However, one of the things which you might enjoy, that we boxed up and I marked as like priority scan this first, was Philip had a filing cabinet of Fair Radio Sales catalogs.
Oh, cool. Very
and
cool.
They went back to, I think, the 70s. And there was generally two catalogs a year. There was like the main catalog and then like a supplement catalog. And right. So I went through and took, one of each, the best one I could find of each, and threw it in a box. And so those should be start to appear pretty soon. So that's kind of fun. He showed me one other box. He's like, here's some more catalogs. And I'm like, are these different than the ones I found there? He's like, there may be some that are different. And this box was covered in mouse poop. And I was just like, you know what? I'm not going to risk antivirus or whatever you get from mouse poop. It was just like, okay, you know, we can't save it all. Besides the catalogs, there was commercial radio gear manuals. There was military and government radio gear stuff. There was avionics stuff. There was catalogs for electronic equipment. Some of these catalogs are, 4 or 5 inches thick. we took it all, we boxed it up, and it'll all get done. So it was a good time. Want to see some pictures?
Yeah,
this will be real fun for the people listening on audio. But
in the meantime, it probably would help the audience, because Fair Radio Sales was a creature of the government overproduction in the World War II and subsequent eras, and Fair Radio Sales actually was one of those fabled places that acquired honest to goodness government surplus. It was just so that was the majority of their inventory. Whoa. Was things that they had bought in at auction, from government declaring it no longer needed. So yeah, that's Fair Radio Sales in all its glory.
So I just threw together some pictures, kind of took pictures. Here's the outside of the building, and I'll try to make this interesting for the audio people. The sign outside, beautiful property.
The thing is funny is that this Fair Radio has not changed much over the decades. same inventory, same prices, same business model. I think the most modern thing about Fair Radio Sales is the fact that, astonishingly, they have a website.
the place was founded by Philip's parents. So he was second generation running this thing. Oh, I guess the auction starts today. If we get this posted quickly, then you might be able to, listener might be able to get out there to see the auction. So here's just some pictures. We've got filing cabinets filled with paper material. I think this is before I started picking through it. There's another filing cabinet just loaded with stuff. And you can see in this particular file cabinet, there were multiple copies of each manual. They're in stacks, and generally they were, there might be 10 or 50 copies of the same thing. So I didn't take everything you see in this picture, try to take, a nice copy of each one. Generally not the one on top, because it was the dirtiest and the most shelf worn.
Yeah. For the listeners, Kay texted me one particular book and asked me to look it up, since he was, staying busy. And sure enough, that particular book was not anywhere on the internet as a scanned item. Some people were selling some hard copies of it, but so these are going to be unique things that are going to be added to Internet Archive and DLARC that, people in future generations are going to be looking up, and because of what you did, Kay, they're going to be able to find it.
These were the avionics books that I had actually asked you about. We had some discussion about that. Right. And here's some of the, just one of the many rows and rows of radio gear stuff going back to,
Well, this is a view of the clean stuff. Yes. This is the storefront, the people where their people are intended to browse. The stacks are an entire warehouse as I said, 20 feet high, just rows and rows of boxes and boxes.
I think I have some pictures of that coming up. This was a picture of the first load nicely boxed manuals in the van. And there's a sign in the van that says, do not exceed 3,750 pounds of load capacity. And we estimated 50 pounds per box, 75 boxes. So we did exactly what we estimated the load capacity was. It's like 75 boxes of stuff. Then I drove it all to,
oh, wow.
Now we're looking at, we're in Fort Wayne, and this is some of the stuff I had sent previously that is in the stacks ready to get scanned.
So just a little point of context. I recognize the orange binder. Those are from DeVry. Those are instructional manuals from DeVry for their electronics courses.
That's what they are. Yes.
As a proud student of DeVry, I recognize them.
So we're looking at a couple of bookshelves stacked nicely with material. They all have little labels hanging off them that are barcode labels so that they know what's what. This is when the first stuff load from the van was stacked up in the scanning center, ready to go. Here's a bunch of boxes marked finished DLARC, and this is just some stuff that they have already scanned and is ready to go to the permanent storage facility. All right, then we're back at Fair Radio Sales in Lima, Ohio, and now we're in the stacks, in the back room where it was super dusty and super moldy, and you've got 20 foot high stacks of gear. Then I went outside, and there was just stuff out. I don't know, maybe stuff out just in the elements, just sitting outside. This is Reagan. He is a good boy, and he helped us. This is me and Philip.
Ah, okay.
Yep. Some other pictures of gear and stuff. This is the second load in the van. We went beyond the carrying capacity of the van this time. And also we ran out of boxes that I pre-ordered. So we started using other boxes that we had gotten from another source.
Okay.
Now we are, drove all that back. And then this is back in the scanning center. And you can see this is the full load of everything.
Well, looks like they are going to be busy for quite a while.
Yes, I think so. Yeah, it is a lot of material. And I got a little tour of the scanning center, which was cool. My buddy Jeff, who I had only met online, works there and runs a scanning center, and he showed me how it all works. There was an interesting board of things that they have found in books while scanning, people's bookmarks or whatever, there's a $5 note from, I'm not sure if it's dollars, but from some very old $5 bill, it looks like, just various pictures a 5 cent off Joy detergent coupon and things like that, and I got a very bad picture of it, but. This is a lizard. Someone found a dead lizard in a book, and
you were worried about mouse droppings,
right? Yeah. This last one is a warning. when I have people ship stuff to DLARC, I always ask them to use a new double walled cardboard box, and sometimes people don't. They just use whatever old box that they have sitting around or whatever. And when you ship something via FedEx or UPS or whatever to the scanning center in an old single walled box, this is what happens to it. It falls apart, and sometimes material falls out.
Yeah, you would when so I soft spot in my mind for the Fort Wayne Scanning Center, because that's where you've had me send most of my material as I donated it to DLARC. And then you sent me back a photo that had come back from the scanning center of one of my boxes, which I felt I had done a good job with. And it had split. And because, you know, it's full of, you know, 30 pounds plus of paper. So it's just dense, and, you know, the box isn't up to it. So I then altered my approach. I used strapping tape, at least two layers of strapping tape around the box, over the box, and the other way. So it was pretty invulnerable by the time. Took a little bit more work and a little bit more expense but I haven't had any complaints since then. So
thank you for your diligence. So did the two loads and got to tour the scanning center, and then I was expecting it would take 3 days, but it took two full days for me and my two assistants. And then that was it. We all went home and called it good. And now the real work begins for the people at the scanning center.
And so the process is that they will unbox it, scan it, add the metadata, or is that you that does the metadata?
They will do the metadata for most of it. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
And, I look forward to an article in a couple of months of, you know, highlighting some of the things that were actually scanned and are now online from DLARC.
I look forward to that too. Some of the Bob Cooper stuff from last month is starting to appear. And so I'll talk about that, you know, in a couple of weeks, I think.
Yeah.
So that's me. What have you been up to, Steve?
Well, last week, in the past week, Zero Retries 0164 came out, and it was mentioned, or an article, a primary article, which I'll talk about in a second, was mentioned in Amateur Radio Weekly, which goes out to thousands of people.
Love that publication.
It's pure, you know, it's distilled wisdom. You know, the editor, Cale Muth, K4HCK, if memory serves, has a fantastic eye for, you know, getting a sense of what happened in amateur radio this week. An article in Zero Retries was featured, and it took me from the mid 1900s to well over 2000 subscribers. So that feels like a big deal.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, that feels good. And last week, no, week before last, my wife and I visited the USS Sampson, which was in Seattle for Fleet Week. And it is a Arleigh Burke class destroyer of the US Navy. And as you get a really profound respect for, you know, the Navy and its capabilities when you actually physically get to walk up and touch something like that. And, you know, as I said, she is all about deadly purpose when that is required. And, you know, the crew was incredibly nice and polite and just exuded competence. I mean, you know, like, they knew their jobs, they knew their ship, they knew their capabilities. You know, do not mess with the US Navy destroyer. You will end up on the losing end. Mm-hmm. So that was fun. And then the article was about the M17 new digital voice and data system that is all about open source. And I had been following M17, admittedly, on the technical side, because it was a modern digital voice system that had been implemented in the last 5 years. It had been created in the last 5 years. And that was the reason I was interested in it, because they had done a fantastic job of speccing it out, including the data portion. So you cannot interoperate data and voice in M17 interchangeably. It does both well. And what I had originally been covering in Zero Retries was that all of the pieces had gradually fallen into place for it to be a viable system. And the crowning piece was a brand new radio from Kinect Systems called the CS7000M17 portable radio. And it's the first one that does M17 out of the box. And it's not quite out of the box yet because the firmware is still evolving slightly, but those are just, you know, updates rather than adding M17 from scratch. So that was kind of the crowning glory, and that's what's putting M17 on the map, you know, because there's a radio for it now. You can play M17, you know, buy it and use it. But what I came to appreciate, and it was entirely because of the audience of Zero Retries that brought, you know, that finally got this through to in my head, was that M17 was better technology. It was that it was open source. You know, it's 100%, M17 is 100% open source. Nobody asserts a right to the name, or that, you know, they haven't trademarked it, they haven't copyrighted it. The individual software is copyrighted. I don't know if the spec is, but anyway, it's all open. And that the audience of Zero Retries, you know, explained this to me, you know, very patiently says, we're not in it because it's better technology, although it is. We're in it because it's open source and we can understand it. We can dive into it. We can tinker with it. We can expand it. You know, we can transmogrify it, you know, and that is the, and that message is just being not landing with the majority of amateur radio. They just don't understand, you know, another digital voice system, you know, on top of the three primary ones that we already use. But the three primary ones that we already use are encumbered in various ways. They're obscure. Supposedly there's a spec, but it's, you know, buried. There's copyrights on proprietary trademark, the proprietary codec, especially the digital voice codec. So M17 is getting a lot of attention, and it's coming, but that attention, which is the cool part, is that it's coming from folks that are coming into amateur radio from the hacker community, from the maker community, from the techie community, and especially the younger folks. There's an article that I'll feature in Zero Retries this week that talks about how a buddy of mine, Dan Romanchuk, KB6NU, went to DEF CON to do a presentation about amateur radio, couched in the language of that crowd, which is, you know, you can hack on radio using amateur radio if you get your license, and you can do cool things with your license. And they said, sounds good, sign me up. And sure enough, there was a VE session, and Dan didn't capture how many people actually passed and got their amateur radio license. But think about the implication of that. These are people that are coming into amateur radio with none of the historical baggage. They don't care about DXing. They don't much care about HF. They don't care about, you know, contesting or any of that. They want to hack on radio. And I think amateur radio is going to be much, much richer for that new energy to come in. And, you know, and they've got M17 waiting for them. And that's, you know, and what's cool about M17 can be, you know, implemented. Well, the creator of M17 just, and I explained this in the last issue of Zero Retries, hacked it into a Game Boy Advance, you know. Yeah. So, you know, there was a tiny little element of M17 running on a Game Boy Advance. So that is the cool part. So then there was a little bit of bad news last week in Zero Retries that a company called NextNav is proposing to the FCC that they that the FCC reconfigure the 902 to 928 megahertz band, which is shared between amateur radio and unlicensed. Now, in the US, this is the primary band where Meshtastic operates. So this is a big deal that they're going to without going too far into the weeds, they propose to do a terrestrial navigation system to, they claim, supplement GPS, because that's a hot new buzzword, because we're worried about GPS, you know, getting blasted out of the sky by hostile powers. So they're proposing to change the band to take over more than half of it for their exclusive use and basically push everybody else out. And they bought licenses back to do a navigation system back in the early 2000s, but they couldn't make the technology work under the conditions that they bought the licenses in. So they're proposing to, you know, change the rules after the fact to finally make use of their license. And I expect a huge pushback because, among other things, 902 to 928 is used by every automatic meter reading system in the U.S. Mm-hmm. So back in my house in Woodinville, Washington, there were I had three 902 to 928 transmitters, one for the gas meter, one for the water meter, and one for the electric meter. So, you know, there's a huge user community that has grown up in the time that they've had this license and tried to make their technology work. And I suspect, and this is just my personal speculation, I suspect that they're trying to make this change. Then they won't be able to, they still won't be able to make the technology work. It'll be, you know, too expensive, blah, blah, blah. Then they will sell their licenses to some other entity for mm-hmm. a big profit. Mm-hmm. So I'm pushing back hard on this and in my own capacity. And, you know, now that I have some gravitas with zero retries, I'm going to do that. I hope the ARRL just put out a bulletin to all of its members to alert them of this. Unfortunately, what happens a lot of times is the amateur community responds with, you know, emotional, you know, it's like, oh, those bastards, you know.
But they don't do the thing of writing.
Right.
Is there a website or some sort of really easy, like, amateur radio take action tool that says, like, you know, just like that explains the problem succinctly. Here is what to write. Here's how to write. Here's where you send it to. And here's the deadline.
The ARRL claims to have put a link in that. The story I read, I just saw this notification first thing this morning, so I didn't get a chance to look at it before the podcast. But I believe that will be the case, and we can put that in the... The ARRL has a site that says, here's the format. And the FCC allows commenting electronically. So mm-hmm. you just go to the website, fill out your information. The main thing to relate is that you have standing as an amateur radio operator, you know, that you have skin in this game and you have a right to be heard. Mm-hmm. But I hope the really strong comments come from organizations like ARDC and Meshtastic is already, I believe, either has submitted or will soon submit their comments about, you know, how it affects their community. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, Meshtastic is just as important a user of 902 to 928 as amateur radio, because mm-hmm. they're getting people excited about experimenting with radio technology. So, and we'll put that Meshtastic bulletin in the show notes also. So that's it. So, and reply comments are due, I think, in early August. I should have put that note in my show notes here. But the timeline is really short. It's about 30 days from the date that they publish this notice. And then there's going to be a second round, what are called reply comments, where you get to comment on the comments. You know, basically say, you know, for the first round of comments, says NextNet is, you know, completely, you know, erroneous in their assertions. And then people will comment, and then you can reply to all those comments. So it's a total 60 or so day period of, you know, activity. Then the FCC gets to withdraw into its inner sanctum and, you know, carefully consider things. Now we're still waiting for the last round of this that we hoped that they would remove all the symbol rates and bandwidth limits from the amateur radio VHF, UHF bands. They haven't chosen to respond to that yet, or they haven't made a final decision and announced it. So hopefully that will come at some point. So that's the big news. And, you know, I didn't need another big project for the summer, but, you know, you don't get to choose these things. So I won't. And to be clear, I think 902 to 928 is very important to amateur radio, and especially the future of amateur radio, mm-hmm. because we are going to have this new tech. Well, we've have had this new technology for 902.928. It's the equivalent of Wi-Fi. It's a standardized set of protocols and equipment called, let's see, the IEEE standard is 802.11ah, lowercase a, lowercase h. And the Wi-Fi consortium, their version of that, which they certify interoperability, is called Wi-Fi Halo, capital H-A, capital L-O-W. And that means that we're going to have equipment coming out soon that is going to be very capable. It's designed for consumer use, and amateur radio will be able to adapt it. One of the things that amateur radio can do in 902.928 is run higher power than, you know, the Part 15 users. Mm-hmm. So we'll be able to, you know, in places where we have microwave networks and that have to have a clear line of sight, you can run a parallel network that will be slow, perhaps slower, but it can penetrate through trees. And you can now, these are going to be inexpensive enough that you can form up neighborhood area networks, just like what MeshTastic is doing. So this matters to amateur radio. And the sad precedent is that amateur radio lost the 220 to 222 megahertz band, you know, decades ago. And it turned out that originally it was supposed to be for UPS's national data system for all their vehicles, and they never ended up using it because cellular became, you know, so much better alternative.
But it's okay because the FCC went, oh, we're sorry, they gave it right back, right?
No, it just floundered. It's barely in use these days. The only use I know of is for the inland waterway communication system, which is the Mississippi River and a few other places, which could easily be handled by cellular now. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that's going to keep me busy for the next month until 2 months, actually. I'm going to be staying on top of this and reporting out in zero retries about this stuff. And I'm glad the ARRL finally engaged, but I was surprised it took them. You know, this came out a week ago and they're finally, you know, getting around to issuing a bulletin. So yeah, that's about all I got. We're just staying busy and with zero retries, and yeah, it's so much fun writing it. You know, it just keeps me busy. I was explaining that to somebody, you know, I never imagined that zero retries was going to take up so much of my life, but it's joyful work. So lots of fun.
Great. That's important.
Yeah.
Doing something that you love. Awesome.
So thanks for what you do and adding to the store of knowledge for amateur radio and, you know, easily findable.
You're quite welcome. I'm doing too.
So what was the coolest and weirdest one thing that you found at Fair Radio?
I don't know. I didn't get to enjoy this material. I just started stuffing it in boxes, you know. it was a time limited thing, and some of the wild stuff in the military radio manuals. And there was literally one that was called like using the radio in your tank. And it probably said what kind of tank. I don't remember. It's just like, you know, how to do radio communications from inside your Sherman tank, or, you know, whatever it was. That was kind of funny.
Well, what struck me about those older, you know, manuals is that they assumed a much greater knowledge of electronics, and the repair manuals would drill down to the component level and say, you know, if it's this particular symptom, it's likely going to be this transistor or this resistor, and so replace this. And so you would end up, you know, repairing circuit boards. Of course, back then they were a lot easier to work on. They were, you know, through hole components, etc. But the process now is you don't troubleshoot down to the, you know, component level, you troubleshoot to the board level, and then you do what's called a line replaceable unit. You pull out the bad card and slap in a new one, and you're back up and running. But that requires a lot of logistics. But, you know, that the one thing that the United States military is far superior on is apparently logistics.
Sure.
And
Yeah. And it's just so many manuals, so many versions of manuals. There'll be, you know, the whatever, the April 1959 version of a manual, and then the June 1959 version, you know, with probably two changes, but let's print a whole new thing. And yeah.
one of the funnier ones was that that I read about a long time ago was that microfiche was a huge step change in documentation for the military, because there were somebody once said that something like the you know some significant percentage, like 10% of the entire weight of a Navy ship was in the documentation. And they, you know, and it was stuffed everywhere, you know, the engine manuals, the munitions manuals, the training manuals. I mean, because, you know, when you're underway and, you know, things are going normal and you're not shooting at people, you know, you've got time to train. So people would study and, you know, to get promotions, you know, and all that stuff, it was on paper, on that ship somewhere. So, yeah. And the Lima's claim to fame, if I recall, is that it's the manufacturing site of army for army tanks.
Yes,
This is
I heard
the,
that when I was there. Yeah.
yeah. So that's Lima's claim to fame for being in the world, is they make the best tanks in the world.
I bet they
So,
do.
yep. So,
Nice. All right.
well, good to talk to you again, and
Good to
welcome
talk to
back,
you.
and
Thank you.
enjoy the cooler weather, and you know, for the rest of our beautiful summers.
I am. I got to say the weather in Lima and in Fort Wayne and between them was perfect. No rain, 70 degrees. It's
Oh, there you go.
perfect loading up the van with boxes and driving from point A to point B in weather. Like,
Well,
so.
what amazes me was that the stacks that you were shot, I didn't realize that those were stacks of the same material. So you know, the fact that I can't imagine the stuff you left behind, how much stuff you left behind that you didn't need duplicates, you know, of. So,
Hopefully it's going to a loving home right now in an auction. I don't know.
it's going to be fascinating to hear what the proceeds, you know, what the aftermath of that auction is going to
Yeah.
be. You know,
Yeah. There's
is that stuff
so
actually going to find a
I
home?
don't know. Yeah, it's so much return. And how are they going to auction it? I mean, it would have to be this room, you know. $5,000, the bidding starts now. You know, I mean, because they're not going to do it per item. It was just too much stuff, just too much. So,
Yeah,
anyway.
you really, unless you'd seen it up close, you really can't appreciate the scale of this, you know, this facility. And
I had said to someone it was like, it seemed, I don't know the square footage, but it seemed to be as big as the Internet Archive's physical storage facility in Richmond, California, as big, but a lot less clean.
yeah, definitely. Well, it was like a, you know, because of Lima's history for building tanks, I mean, they, you know, there were facilities spread all over Lima, and I'm guessing that this was some former logistics hub that, you know, once we got out of making the Sherman tanks, you know, we didn't need quite that much warehouse space, and so this would became surplus. So the Midwest is just, you know, littered with facilities like that. That, you know, and the business model of Fair Radio was cheap pro you know cheap input products and cheap storage space, until, you know, just didn't want it anymore. So,
All
well,
right.
good on you. Good on you and your buddies to having rescued all that stuff. Look forward to it.
Thank you. We'll know more when we know more. This has been episode 4 of Store and Forward, your podcast about the past and future of amateur radio. I am Kay Savitz, K6KJN. Of Digital Library of Amateur Radio and Communications. You can contact me at kay at archive.org.
And I am Steve Stroh, N8GNJ, and I am editor of Zero Retries newsletter, which can be found at www.zero retries, RETRIES. And make sure your spell corrector doesn't change it to zero retires dot org. So, and publishes every week. You can subscribe for free. Join the fun. There's 2,000 other co-conspirators for the future of amateur radio.
Talk to you in a couple weeks.
7-3.